I was elected by men and women of all parties and none, by many with great moral courage, who stepped out from the faded flags of the Civil War and voted for a new Ireland, and above all, by the women of Ireland, Manon Aheron.
She was a total tomboy. Wasn't she brought up by her four brothers? And what else could she be?
There was a kind of a driving force behind her. I mean, she was genuinely committed. She was intellectually excited by the law.
How dare any political party talk about political hooks when we should be changing the law in order to make life better and healthier and saner for the people of this country, for the women of this country and the children of this country?
We are marching to stop the destruction of Wood Quay. And we are marching for the construction of civic offices to be constructed elsewhere.
I have such a sense of what the world must take responsibility for.
To my mind, her feminist thing, or her all this, is the law. The sheer inequality of the law was the one to put right.
I am of Ireland. Come dance with me in Ireland.
Mary Robinson, in the first programme in this series, you spoke of growing up in Ballina, a happy and privileged childhood, the doctor's daughter, boarding school in Dublin, the Sacred Heart Nuns, your belief that you had a vocation to become a nun, your year in Paris at 17, your crisis of faith, belief then that you should be a lawyer, studying law in Trinity, then teaching there, becoming a senator at 25, Trinity constituency. Changing from Mary Burke to becoming Mary Robinson, despite your parents' opposition. But now you are practicing law, teaching law, and as a senator, potentially making law. You were intellectually out to change the world, insisting on equality. And this is how your father saw you.
To my mind, her feminist thing, or her all this, is the law. Above all else, she was a lawyer. The sheer inequality of the law was the one to put right.
That is the key, isn't it, to you? You recognise that law was the instrument of change.
Very much so, and it was wonderful to be able to see law from the different perspectives, to have the privilege of being involved in the Oireachtas and the Senate in seeking to change the law as it was going through or introduce private members' bills, to be teaching law. I love teaching. I still love teaching. And to then practice law, but be lucky enough, because I had the income from a senate and part-time teaching, because it wasn't a big salary, but that enabled me to choose the kind of cases that I'd like to do.
And Ireland was then, it was full of agreed hypocrisies, wasn't it? There were understandings that things weren't quite what we pretended they were.
I think that was very much the case. We had Irish ways of not talking about things and of shifting our problems. And I wanted to bring about social change, whether it was to remove the status of illegitimacy for children. No child should be called illegitimate. And we started that with a private members' bill, the family planning legislation, obviously. And as well as that, I realised that we could take cases that would become what we call test cases. And a case for one individual could affect a whole range of people. And I loved those cases.
And what irked you? I mean, there were dress codes in the Senate when you arrived, and there were dress codes in the law library, weren't there?
When I arrived in the Senate and I was, you know, 25, quite intimidated by the formal process of registering for the Senate. And I met a Fianna Fáil Senator Kit O'Hearn, who had been a member of the Senate for a number of years, and she welcomed me, but she made it quite clear that lady senators wore hats. And I had a small beret that I wore on the first day and got photographed, and then I realised this wasn't law or anything, it was just a custom. And I threw away the beret, but had to endure the photograph for quite a while. Similarly, in the law library, I had a very nice, elegant trouser suit, a dark grey, dark pinstripe, and I enjoyed wearing it. And then I was away, I think, on circuit and came back, and in the women's robing room there was a notice saying at a meeting of ladies of the bar it was decided that ladies would not wear trousers. And I looked at this and thought to myself, well...
Did you think it was aimed at you?
I was pretty sure it was aimed at me, but I was also aware that this wasn't a formal meeting. It was, so I decided to add some of, at a meeting of some of, some of them decided, and I never heard any more.
Did the word lady itself annoy you?
Yes, and I noticed that men, some men still say ladies because they don't understand the importance of actually women. And so it's an old-fashioned way, but it's also one that I think doesn't really promote equality.
Now, the cases that you then took up, Josie Airey was one such case, and a very important case it was. And here she is talking later about it. So let's hear her first.
When I went into the courts to get a legal separation, I never knew anything about the law, or I never knew anything about courts. And I had a solicitor there, like, and I thought, you know, you'd have a case, you'd just go in and get your legal separation. But when I went into the courts, I was horrified and I was appalled at the state of the system and the way they treat poor people, and there I was horrified at learned men manipulating people and sort of taking advantage of them because they hadn't education. So I just decided I was going to do something about it, and that day when I left the court, I got on the bus, I was furious, and I knew then I was going to do something about the system.
How important was her case?
What was extremely important about her case was her own sense of her right to justice. She was a compelling person, and she started it all. She wrote that letter to the Commission of Human Rights in Strasbourg. The letter contained a lot of irrelevant stuff, but good lawyers in the Commission understood that she wanted to get a judicial separation. Her husband had been convicted in the district court of assaulting her and got a small fine. So there was some, you know, objective evidence there that she would need a separation. And no solicitor would take her case, and she decided to...
Why would no solicitor take her case?
Because it would be expensive to go into the High Court, and even if they won, her husband was no mark for costs. He wouldn't be able to pay either. So they just wouldn't take her case, effectively. And there was no civil legal aid. That was the issue. So the Commission referred the case to the Irish government, which responded by saying that the High Court was open to anyone. She could go in and do her own case. And they were a bit suspicious of that. So they...
In Strasbourg they were suspicious.
In Strasbourg they were suspicious. So they got... decided to provide legal aid for the case to be argued in Strasbourg. And Brendan Walsh became the solicitor who instructed me as the barrister to take that case. And it was a speculative case in the sense that no such case had ever been argued. There had been one case before that Ireland brought against Ireland that had failed, and nobody had a precedent of how to do this. So it was very new, and I found it a wonderful case to argue, partly because Josie Airey was such a determined, fine woman with a great spirit. And she came to Strasbourg with us when we argued the case before the Commission, and we were helped by the Commission, which first of all said that we had a case that was admissible, because the Irish courts were trying to have, the Irish government was trying to say that it shouldn't be admissible at all. And then the real point was we showed that no lay litigant had ever taken a successful case for judicial separation. There was no record. So how could this woman from Cork go into the High Court and argue for herself? And we won before the court. Ireland was found to be in breach of two articles on access to the courts and on protection of family life. And the response of the government was to accept the judgment and introduce civil legal aid. So it was an example of one woman not just finding justice for herself in that sense, but also being able to change the situation for so many others. And she got a small amount of damages from the court, which again was unusual.
But this was making headlines, of course, too. It was a test case. It was very widely publicised.
It was widely publicised, not just in Ireland, but in Europe. It's a very well-known case in Europe because, of course, if you change the law under the Strasbourg system, you change it for the whole Council of Europe.
So Mrs. Airey becomes part of legal history in a way.
Very much so.
Yeah. Were you accused by any of the establishment here of kind of washing our, helping to wash our linen in public, abroad?
Not really. The Irish government, I felt, in their instructions to their counsel, tried to be very dismissive initially and cut us out at the admissibility stage. But they should have known that if the Commission was providing legal aid, they already felt there was an argument to be made. But what I remember still was after the judgment, I got a note from Tommy Connolly, who was a god to me of constitutional law, if you like, as a young lawyer. And it was a lovely handwritten note commending me on a great legal victory, etc. And I treasured that note.
And there were other such test cases on gay rights, for instance.
Yes, taking the case for David Norris was also, for me, a very passionate challenge because I had been aware of this discrimination against gay people. And I remember joking when we got to the court with David that it was becoming more and more difficult because he was now a distinguished lecturer in literature in Trinity in English, and he was also elected to the Senate. And, you know, how was I? But in fact, the discrimination was very real. He wrote me a personal account of what it was like as a 14, 15, 16 year old to recognise that he was different and that if he expressed his sexuality, it was criminal and what that meant to him. And there were so many others who didn't come out as he had done. And because of that case, the law was changed in Ireland and created space for gay people, which was incredibly important.
And he was an exceptional and very courageous witness.
He was indeed, and also very witty and fun to be with.
Meanwhile, in the Senate, you were still trying to get the contraception issue onto the agenda. And it was the 70s. There's a lot of movement on it, but nothing is happening, really.
One important way in which we moved it, and the bills, there were two bills, were published, was health being the framing of family planning, not criminal law. And that in itself was important. And ultimately, the government bill which went through was a health measure.
Meanwhile, though, the Fine Gael Labour Coalition had brought forward legislation. Paddy Cooney, as Minister for Justice, because it was coming from Justice at that time in 1974, brought forward legislation which was voted against by his own Taoiseach, Liam Cosgrave, on a free vote. But that was still a surprise to his cabinet colleagues.
And I remember, you know, in one way, you know, the cartoons about it showed how absurd it was that a Taoiseach and other senior ministers would vote against their own measure. But underneath it, it just showed how deep the resistance was to legislating for sexual relations, for being able to use contraceptives. And whereas at the time this was quite painful to me, I learned a very, very important lesson for later, which I didn't fully appreciate. When I became High Commissioner for Human Rights, I was addressing human rights issues in the Muslim world. And I was being told, human rights are a Western concept. Our children marry very young. Women don't go into public places, etc. And that's our culture. And I was able to be more patient, I must say, and realise that this has to be worked through, but that there is a very strong need to talk about traditional practice when you're talking about early child marriage or female genital cutting, and that it's not culture, and in fact it's harmful traditional practice. And you try to then educate from within about the change that needs to take place. So the lessons of how we dealt with the family planning issue were very valuable to me afterwards.
But what the evidence shows also is that those who are to whom it is most relevant, i.e. women of childbearing age, were already taking their own decisions. It was the older men who were judges or bishops or politicians or doctors even who were late to see what was happening and to catch up.
That's right. There was the famous going to Belfast to buy the contraceptives and bring them down by train. I didn't take part in that because I wanted to be the lawyer arguing the case, trying to change the law, rather than be an activist at that stage on the ground.
Is there a part of you who isn't a joiner in that sense, that you like to stay back and be the legal person?
Certainly at that stage, I not only wanted to be the legal person, but I was also not identifying myself in a very clear way with the women's liberation movement. I was legal advisor to the movement. I was helping. Yvonne Boland rang me up one day wanting laws that discriminate against women. She wanted 7 laws, and I queried her and I said, I can give you more than 7. And she said, no, it's a short meeting, Mary. 7 will be enough. But
why didn't you join?
Because I wanted, as a lawyer, as a constitutional lawyer, not to be bracketed. She's a feminist, so therefore she can somehow only talk about women's issues. It was partly a defensive and partly a strategic thing. I wanted also to take other cases, which I was doing, cases on other justice and human rights issues, and not just issues relating to women. And I'm much, much more comfortable now with affirming that I am, yes, a feminist and espousing the feminist cause very strongly and understanding the importance of it. But at that time, and I think that's often true of younger women, they don't want to be typecast or stereotyped as feminists. And but you're right that it was women who were actively determined to get access to family planning. And of course, we had the paradox that married women could get the contraceptive pill if their doctor certified that they had cycle regulation problems. And we used to joke that it must have been the Irish weather that so many married women had cycle regulation problems as a fig leaf or fiction to get the contraceptive pill.
Mm. John Bonner is on record as saying that it was in the history of womankind there was never such an incidence of cycle irregularity. Meanwhile, the contraceptive issue continued to preoccupy you. And at one stage, when it was being revisited by the Fine Gael Labour Coalition in early 1977, you had this to say.
There are women in this country, there are families in this country who are oppressed by the present situation, who can't get advice, who can't get help. How dare any political party talk about political hooks when we should be changing the law in order to make life better and healthier and saner for the people of this country, for the women of this country and the children of this country? How dare Fianna Fáil start talking about having the coalition on a hook? And I think it's a nonsense.
You were pretty angry on that occasion.
I was. I felt very passionate about the issue and about other issues of justice. And I think that was partly why I was so pleased to have different ways of dealing with it as part of the law in the Senate and trying to take cases that would move the agenda forward. For example, on divorce, there was the Johnson case, which I was involved in, where Roy Johnson had been married before and was now living with a woman and had a daughter, but she was illegitimate, he was not her guardian, etc. And they very courageously took that case because it meant they didn't have the privacy of the family courts out of the public gaze. And we tried to address both the divorce issue and the status of the family, and in particular that the daughter should not be branded as illegitimate and have less rights than a child born within marriage. We won on that issue, but Ireland, when we joined the Strasbourg Convention on Human Rights and Civil Liberties, Ireland had said that it wanted to have a caveat about it not resulting in a change in the divorce law in Ireland.
You were also an enthusiastic supporter of Ireland's joining the European Economic Community, as it was at that time.
Yes, I was very keen that membership of the European Economic Community could take Ireland out of what I felt was a kind of prison of always defining ourselves in relation to Big Brother Britain. And usually it was a kind of negative defining. It was a post-colonial hangover defining. And Britain, for its part, didn't think much of Ireland and even less, I think, of Northern Ireland. We were sort of a backwater. Whereas France liked our culture and Italy liked our landscape and Germany liked our literature. And we had, you know, much more likelihood of being a sovereign country among other countries. And also we could influence this whole. But I also very much respected the argument on the other side. People like Justin Keating and others saying, look, you know, we've struggled throughout history. And I felt very much about that. Why should we now become part of a homogenised whole and lose our full sense of sovereignty? But on balance, and strongly on balance, I felt that membership of the EU would be good for us economically, in our identity, politically, culturally. And I believe it was and is.
Meanwhile, you did then decide to join the Labour Party as a senator. So you were no longer an independent senator for Trinity. You were taking the Labour whip.
And that was very much because my own passion and interest had deepened. And I wanted also to have an economic rationale for a fairer, more equal society. And the Labour Party seemed to me to be the party that was trying to do that.
And you stood then in two elections, in 77 and in 81, for the Dáil, and you didn't do well. You got 5%, 11%, I think, in the first election and a fraction of that in the second. Why was that, do you think?
In the first election in Rathmines, actually, I nearly got the last seat. There were very few votes between me and Ben Briscoe, who won for Fianna Fáil. And I often wonder what might have happened if it had just gone the other way. I was regarded by part of the Labour Party in the constituency as having been imposed by headquarters, which was the case, because I was a latecomer, I was a high, well-known name, and they wanted me in the constituency.
You were a parachute candidate.
And secondly, the night, by the day before the election, the constituency was had leaflets saying that I was the Robinson of Hayes, Cunningham and Robinson, the chemists, and that I was getting a penny on every pill sold. And that was why I had been interested in family planning. It was notorious stuff. We never quite traced where it came from, but it did have a damaging effect. I wasn't a good constituency candidate for the Dáil, and I don't think I would have been a good member of the Dáil, because I was not at all impressed with or wanting to continue the kind of clientelism that the TD did everything for you, because I wanted people to be empowered to have a right to their fair housing, their thing. And so the Senate, with arguments about education and issues like that, was much more suitable to the kind of political figure that I was.
So looking back then, were you pleased that that chalice had passed?
Not at the time. You know, you never like to lose. But later, and I think members of my family, including Nick, were relieved. He accepted that I wanted to run for the Dáil, but he was never as enthusiastic, because I think he saw, you know, the implications in time and everything else.
And you then became involved in the Wood Quay dispute. Now, there was a big march in 1978, and the speakers included the Augustinian priest and historian, medieval historian, Father F.X. Martin, and Thomas Kinsella, and yourself.
It is a question of the democratic process. That, to me, is now the nerve centre of the controversy.
It is a marvellous chance that we have, in fact, literally stumbled upon the birthplace of our own city. And the authorities, having destroyed part of it, now propose to finish the work of destruction.
We are marching to stop the destruction of Wood Quay, and we are marching for the construction of civic offices to be constructed elsewhere.
Again, you were legal advisor. Were you, you took occupation as well, did you?
No, I never did. No, because being legal counsel, it would have been inappropriate. It was Nick who was approached first because of his involvement in conservation issues and our friendship with Eddie McParland, etc. So Father F.X. Martin approached him to be the instructing solicitor. And Nick decided, because this was a very difficult case, that he would instruct me as the barrister. And Donald Barrington was then retained as senior counsel and was a great advocate for us. It was an incredible time to have people, you know, like Mary Lavin and others, you know, so involved from a literary cultural point of view, because Wood Quay could have been such a wonderful asset to the capital city of Ireland, like York, to have this wonderful Viking remains of settlements that were so well preserved. So there were the legal issues, but there was also at the heart of it the passion about medieval Dublin. And it was an interesting case. We won initially because Wood Quay was declared a national monument. And then there was a small clause that if the corporation and the commissioners of public works jointly signed for the destruction, you could destroy a national monument. And we challenged that and we lost. And then there was the occupation, and there was an injunction sought. And in the High Court, the injunction was refused, which was absurd. But the judge felt passionate about the issue, and it was appealed to the Supreme Court. And I will never forget going into the Supreme Court and watching the judges come out. I was leading at that time, watching the judges come out with copies of the Forcible Entry Act in their hands. Nobody'd argued the Forcible Entry Act, which could put you in jail, but they had it in their hands. And the Supreme Court not only did not hear my arguments, but I was told in no uncertain terms by the then Chief Justice, Tom O'Higgins, that it was my responsibility to go across the river as quickly as I could and tell those who were occupying the site to vacate it immediately. And Forcible Entry Act was there on the bench. And I remember, you know, going very quickly, red-faced across, and then saying to my friends, look, you know, you've been great to occupy and draw attention to this, but I have to warn you that you will be jailed if you stay here. And most of those left, F.X. Martin, Bride Rosny and others left the site. A few remained on, but the campaign was over at that stage.
And you went back to the court to report?
I went back to the court to report that I had obeyed their instructions.
Was that a very low moment?
It was. It was an embarrassing moment in a way, because professionally I felt very embarrassed. I was keen to take another route and went forward for election to Dublin City Council. I was elected as a councillor, basically on the Woodkey ticket, but as a Labour councillor, because I was still a member of the Labour Party at that stage. And we then tried in Dublin City Council, and we were bullied into being told that the costs of delaying any construction of the civic offices could be costs that we would individually have to bear. And eventually the civic offices did go up. I've never been really very fond of them.
We can take a break here, Mary Robinson, and after the break we'll talk to you about the invitation by the Labour Party that they would propose you as a candidate, an independent candidate, for the presidency.